What makes something go viral? How does an idea, product, or person go from relative obscurity to cultural icon status? Derek Thompson, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly, doesn't believe that kind of popularity happens by accident. In his new book, Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction, he uses science to analyze hits across time and reveals how each success story has a secret history that helped us turn it into a phenomenon. His book is published by Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Derek Thompson to our show today. Hello.
Hey, it's great to be here.
You write in your introduction about the lullaby your mother used to sing to you when you were she wanted you to go to sleep. What was it?
It was Brahms' Lullaby.
She wasn't the only mother who sang that.
Right. Oh, no. I think there are millions of mothers around the world that are deeply familiar with this tune, and many children, therefore, as well.
But you thought it was something she'd composed?
I did. Yeah, for a long time, I think it's only natural to think that, you know, a song that your mother is singing to you is something that she wrote. And so, yeah, I did not know the provenance of this particular lullaby.
Now, Brahms wrote an awful lot of major symphonic works, but did he write this very much with the idea of writing a hit tune?
No. He wrote it for a single mother named Bertha. He had fallen in love with a soprano in Vienna when he was younger. And when she finally married another man and named their first son Johannes, he wanted to write a lullaby that she could sing to her son that could sort of cheekily also be a love song that she was singing in a far-flung way to him. And that's why he wrote the lullaby.
So how did it wind up becoming one of the most familiar tunes in the world?
So he borrowed a tune that Bertha had sung to him. It was a famous folk song. And Brahms was a bit of a cheeky customer. He would travel around Europe and he would go to lullabies and he would look at go to libraries and look at the sheet music of some of the most famous folk songs. And he would basically steal the most interesting parts of those songs so he could incorporate them into his music. It's a bit like, you know, how George Lucas wrote Star Wars in a way. He took his favorite bits of all his favorite stories and threw it into one. And so when it finally arrived in Vienna, when it was finally performed, a lot of people recognized the tune.
So he understood the importance of familiarity.
Exactly.
Is familiarity a really important factor in what you're discussing here?
Familiarity might be the most important
factor. It doesn't
factor.
Breed contempt, actually?
No.
It breeds memory.
It breeds memory. It breeds liking. We like that which is familiar, and we particularly like that which is sneakily familiar. We don't want to hear the same song 17 times in a row, but we love hearing a new song with an old chord structure once, twice, three times in a row.
What role have media played in shaping entertainment? In Brahms' day, how would something like this lullaby have been launched?
Something like this would have been launched in a concert hall. You would have played it for 1,000 people at once. There was no radio technology in the 1800s to distribute this sort of thing around the world. And as a result, hit music took forever to travel. It took 20, 30 years for Beethoven's most famous symphonies to reach New York City and Boston. It's fun to imagine sort of the same thing happening with cultural products today. It taking, you know, 20 years for Seinfeld to reach London. They would be just learning who Jerry Seinfeld is today. So hits traveled very slowly in the 1800s.
But even during my lifetime, hits have traveled differently. Began with, I guess, AM radio, then moved to FM, and then to TV, and now the internet. Maybe I've left out a couple of things.
Well, I think in many ways the long story of media technology, briefly told, is that we built a couple of broadcast technologies that could reach mass audiences, but only a few organizations owned those technologies in the middle of the 20th century. So broadcasting power was aristocratic, I guess you could say. Only a few people could reach tens of millions. But now broadcasting power has democratized. There are podcasts that reach many millions, newsletters that reach many millions, Facebook accounts that reach many millions. And so broadcast power has democratized, and it has changed the way that hits are made.
And also the way we purchase the hit. For example, if I'd heard a record that I liked on an AM show when I was a kid, I then had to remember, write down the name, remember it, go to the record store and hope that they had a 45 of it.
Right.
Now you can just click and get the thing immediately into your computer.
It's frictionless. It's beautiful. It's beautiful for consumers. But what is it like for artists? What is it like when you don't have that 1 a.m. or FM radio station that you know will reach your target audience and you think, well, maybe I reach them on Twitter, maybe on Spotify, maybe through WNYC. It is much more difficult to find the optimal way to reach your target demographic.
So are the gatekeepers more important than the artists in the end?
Well, it's interesting because the gatekeepers used to be few and they used to have all of the power. Record companies, for example, used to be able to dictate tastes in a very clear way. You had payola, where the record labels would literally pay the radio DJs to play their favorite songs, say, you know, play the Rolling Stones over and over again.
And, I came along too late.
And by sheer familiarity, they would fall in love with that Rolling Stones song. And they also could tell the record store owners to tell Billboard that certain songs were selling the fastest, so those songs would soar up the Billboard charts. But now, hits seem to come more from the bottom. So if you're a record company and you're trying to make a song go quote-unquote viral, make it go really, really big at once, you can't dictate taste from the top. You're more likely to have a successful song if you can find, say, a meme that you can attach the song to that emerges from the public.
And in many cases, the artists are doing it themselves. They have become artists and impresarios at the same time.
Yeah, one interesting thing that's happening in Hollywood and in music both is that artists are realizing that they can become their own studios, their own labels. You have, you know, Nicole Kidman and Michael B. Jordan starting their own production companies in Hollywood. You have some musicians essentially saying, I'm famous enough that I don't need a label. And so it's exciting, I think, for new artists to imagine that they don't need these old gatekeepers to achieve popularity. They might be able to build it from the ground up.
You write about Justin Bieber's influence on the fate of a song called Call Me Maybe.
I do. Yeah, one of my favorite pop songs of the century, I guess, is Call Me Maybe, ubiquitous several years ago. But what's really interesting about Call Me Maybe as an example of some of the ideas we've talked about is that Call Me Maybe was not a particularly popular song for a long time, even though when you hear it, it sometimes sounds inherently infectious and contagious. But Justin Bieber, the ubiquitous Canadian pop star, put it out on YouTube and tweeted it out to his followers, and that served essentially as a broadcast moment. Many millions of people discovered the song because Justin Bieber gave it his imprimatur. So right there, I think we have a lovely example of how many decades ago, AM and FM had a monopoly on broadcast exposure. But now, Justin Bieber is a radio station. He has the power to make hits all by himself.
So if you have followers on Twitter or Instagram or whatever, you can automatically reach a lot of people right from the start. On the other hand, does the variety of available technology also make it more difficult to get someone's attention?
I think that both of these things are happening at the same time, that it's not a paradox. They're simply living with each other. That on the one hand, because broadcast technology has democratized, you have many more people who can essentially reach thousands or millions at once. But this is also, though, how popularity is built. It is built through broadcast. So if you have a new product and you want to get it out there, one of the most important things you can do after designing for familiarity is to find those perfect broadcasts to reach your audience.
My guest is Derek Thompson, whose book is Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. It's published by Penguin Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, the Super Bowl seems to me to be the perfect example of the old school approach. Mm-hmm. But you reach millions and millions of people, and I assume that's why the ads are so expensive. But what kind of impact would it have had on Lady Gaga? She's already a superstar. Do you think her record sales go up as a result of that appearance?
I know that her record sales have gone up as a result of that appearance. The Super Bowl is unlike anything else that exists right now because, exactly as you said, it is an old-fashioned, truly mass media broadcast. Think of it this way. The biggest movie of 2016, Rogue One, the Star Wars film, sold 55 million tickets in the U.S. 110 million people watched the Super Bowl, according to the most conservative estimates. So the Super Bowl was twice as popular as the most popular blockbuster of 2016. It is like a Kilimanjaro over the Serengeti landscape. It doesn't have any equal. And as a result, you have all of these companies recognizing that it is a unique way to reach all of the United States at once in an age of fragmentation.
But then they have to pay $5 million for a 30-second commercial.
Yes.
And every car in the world is advertising during the Super Bowl. Aren't they canceling each other out?
And this is the paradox of the Super Bowl. It is that it is because it is so obviously a broadcast unlike any other broadcast that every major company that can afford $5 million for a 30-second spot advertises in it, and often they cancel each other out. If Coca-Cola and Pepsi both spend their many, many millions of dollars, often they don't move market share. Here's why the Super Bowl, though, is still the king of media. Because if you're a new product, if you're a new app or a new a website or a new movie or artist, then it really has the potential to give you breakout success.
So it can sell a movie better than it can a bowl of soup.
Yes. If that bowl of soup is the only bowl of soup that is advertising in the Super Bowl, then it will probably eke out a bit of market share. But movies, we absolutely know, and musicians clearly benefit tremendously from Super Bowl exposure.
Well, they also are all aiming at coming up with viral ads. Budweiser has a history of them. But there were, after the Super Bowl, we start reading about which ads went viral. Does viral mean success, or does it just mean attention?
Well, I have a chapter in the book called The Viral Myth, where I argue that virality, in the way that we imagine it, doesn't really exist. I think most people think of viral ideas spreading like viral diseases. I get sick, I get you sick, you get two other people sick, and it spreads through many, many, many generations of intimate shares. But information spreads in a very different way. Almost all information that goes big has one extremely important, or several extremely important, broadcast moments. Not a million one-to-one shares, but a few one-to-one million shares. And so for this reason, when something goes big in the Super Bowl, I don't think it makes sense to think of it as a viral disease, because there's no disease that gets 110 million sick in a single hour. This is what we should call broadcasts, not viruses.
Someone sends, a service sends broadcasters all sorts of information every day, and that includes which thing went viral online. Today it was a cat that was climbing around a tree trying to get something out of a bird cage.
It sounds very adorable.
So are there still gatekeepers and opinion makers in the viral world? I mean, how does that suddenly go viral? Who suddenly decides that that's something that should excite everybody? A cat. The cat's real cute, but so.
Right, right. So here's where data scientists can be really, really useful, is in answering a question just like this. How did a video that seems to have come out of nowhere really come out of nowhere? And what they've done is to look at the spread of so-called viral videos. And again, if it truly spreads like a virus, we should see many, many, many generations of one to two sharing. But instead, what they see is a blast moment, several one-to-one million moments. So going back to your example, think about what you said. You said, I was looking at a newsletter that was telling me what the viral things were. That newsletter is a broadcast. It's not a viral mechanism. It's a broadcast. It's a newspaper. It's telling you what's popular. And if you have many different organizations focused on telling people what the most interesting new video is, what the cutest new cat is doing, then you essentially have many broadcasters interested in cat content. And that is how those videos are going viral, is because they are being broadcast.
You have a chapter on the way people respond to art, and it reminded me that that when you go to the Louvre, where there are so many great paintings, it doesn't really matter. There is just a huge crowd around the Mona Lisa. So has the Mona Lisa gone viral in a way? Is that something that went viral 100 years ago?
Well, the story of the Mona Lisa is absolutely beautiful. A lot of people think of the Mona Lisa as the pinnacle, the apotheosis of beautiful painting. It is the most valuable painting in the world in terms of its insurance costs.
But that's because it was stolen once?
But yeah, for a long time, it was not the most valuable painting, even in its own museum. But it was stolen by an Italian around the turn of the century. This theft became an international scandal covered by many newspapers, broadcasters, and it was the scandal of the stealing of the Mona Lisa that made it this international hit. After it was returned to France, it then went on a national tour as if it were the Rolling Stones. It went to Washington, D.C., and New York City, and London, and everyone got to gawk at this painting that had been stolen and almost lost from the world. And that is why it was mimicked so often by 20th century artists, and that's why we recognize it when we see it everywhere. So it, too, benefited from a historical accident that elevated its popularity, and B, a sequence of broadcast moments that told the world that this was a painting unlike other paintings.
In art or in music or in the arts in general, how important are changing tastes? For example, a book will become a bestseller and then 20 years later nobody will remember it. Or I was thinking about Caravaggio and Vermeer, who were famous in their day and then forgotten for centuries and then suddenly became important again. Both of them considered two of the greatest painters in the history of the world. Changing tastes.
I'm completely fascinated by changing tastes, by fashions, and by canons. Because in a way, what you're talking about is fame and canons and, in literature and art. The first chapter of the book tells the story of the Impressionist canon. Why is it that if all of these Impressionist painters were equally hated in the 1870s, that we think only a handful of them are absolute geniuses in the 2010s?
Because some were better than others? Isn't quality a factor? Isn't Monet better than Sicily?
I don't know how you'd prove it
Pissarro?
I don't know how you'd prove it quantitatively, but let's just say that in the 1870s, Monet was not necessarily considered by all people to be that much better than someone like Gustave Caillebotte, who is now relatively obscure. But what happened is that Gustave Caillebotte, this relatively obscure and independently wealthy Impressionist painter, collected a bunch of his friends' paintings while he was living, died prematurely in 1890, bequeathed his collection to the French Museum, created with this bequest the first Impressionist exhibit in a French state museum in history. And who were the painters in that collection? Manet, Monet, Renoir, Degas, Cezanne, Pissarro, and Sicily. Still the core seven Impressionist painters, the canon. He just happened accidentally to have collected all seven. I don't think that Caillebotte necessarily had the greatest taste in the world. He was specifically buying paintings that wouldn't sell to other buyers.
So who was lost?
What happened? Who was lost?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the...
Morisot, you could say. Morisot was lost. You could say that Caillebotte himself was lost because he didn't give himself the gift of exposure. So people who go to the Chicago Art Institute and can see Paris Rainy Day, which is an absolutely gorgeous piece of art that's famous in Chicago, nonetheless don't recognize the name of the painter underneath it. When I was reporting the book, I went to the National Art Gallery in Washington, D.C., and they had an exhibit for Gustave Caillebotte. And they said right there on the placard next to the exhibit, they said, he is probably the least known of the Impressionist painters. But how beautifully ironic that the least known Impressionist painters was the one who created the canon by buying all of these, all of his friends' best works and bequeathing them to a state government that could essentially give the imprimatur of public consecration to make these works famous.
So an exhibit can set the tone, as we saw in New York with the Armory Show, that pretty much set the taste for modern art in America for decades to follow. We have to take a little break. Okay. We'll come back to that and other things. My guest is Derek Thompson. His book, Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction, is published by Penguin Press. Stay with us for more. We're back with Derek Thompson. His book, Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction, is published by Penguin Press. A little more on art before we move on to some other things. Can we say that galleries and museums are the radio stations of the art world?
Yeah,
galleries are going through real bad times nowadays, and art fairs have become the big thing.
Yeah, I think that museums, in many ways, were the original television channel. They were the original radio station, the original Facebook news feed, the first place, other than maybe the Greek amphitheater, where the public could come to look at a collection, a bundle of art, a bundle of artistic works. And because they had the power of exposure and the power of public consecration to tell audiences, this is what matters, this is what's good, they had the power to create stars the same way that today's channels of broadcast exposure do.
How does this apply to political campaigns?
Well, I think we're living in a world right now where you simply can't ignore the power of exposure. If you look at how Donald Trump so dominated the Republican primary to win the nomination of a party that did not want him to be their nominee for the vast, vast majority. I'm talking about the political operatives, did not want him to be their representative. This is a perfect representation of our bottom-up world of hits. Just as in music, where, as we've seen since the early 1990s, the music labels have lost the ability to dictate hits, and we've seen that that music styles that they weren't always paying to promote, like hip-hop and country, have flown up the charts. Tastes in music have been bottom-up. The same thing is happening in politics. The elites used to be able to decide on their nominees and dictate those tastes through television and radio, but now the people have more power and they can decide on their populist heroes even when the elites hate them.
So are political campaigns now just another form of entertainment and of hit production? Are political campaigns basically arms of media companies?
Politics as entertainment is the cliche, but I think the truth is probably one letter different. Politics is entertainment, and it has been entertainment for much longer than we would like to think. We think that 1960 was the first television election. Nope. Dwight Eisenhower in 1956 hired TV stars to make his Republican National Convention the glitziest thing in the world. Once you're elected as a representative today, you probably spend 70% of your time telemarketing. A third of the people who work in the White House, not just this White House, White Houses before, are employed in some aspect of PR. So you can think of the White House as a movie studio, as the with the president as its star and these PR people as the means of distributing the president's message. Politics is entertainment.
But, and how does that apply to the people who talk about politics? If we were following the logic of your argument, cable and the internet would have diminished the power of political commentators, but Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly are still very influential.
Incredibly influential. And you've seen the power shift over time from broadcast networks to cable networks and then to talk radio. And now you see, I think, a resurgence of interest in what's happening on CNN versus Fox News as the one channel that the president has singled out as fake news versus another channel that some people accuse as essentially being Trump's Pravda. So I think that, yes, over time, as technology changes the distribution of information, the locus of power changes. But right now, I think we are truly seeing not only a president who sees himself as essentially a media company, but now a news ecosystem that sees itself as having to broadcast challenging messages against the White House. So, I mean, right now, I think that the theme of politics is entertainment has never been more true.
Well, things do shift. Trump once called CNN his personal booker.
He did, yeah.
And now he calls it fake news. But we have, the Times had an article about a guy who created a bunch of fake news stories. They went viral on the internet. To some degree, I suspect they went viral because people wanted to believe them, even though some of them were absolutely crazy and outrageous. And you have something like Alex Jones, who believes every conspiracy possible,
God.
Some of them so totally unbelievable that it's hard that to imagine anybody would want to listen to him. And yet, he's very popular and very influential.
Absolutely.
Is it that we sometimes gravitate to what we want to hear, want to see?
Oh, of course. Familiarity is powerful not only in music and movies, but incredibly powerful in political journalism. So many readers and listeners and viewers just want to know that their prior biases are true, and they want new and interesting ways to think about the biases they've already come to. But let me just tell a brief story to give people a sense that this is not a new phenomenon. In the 1920s, George Gallup, that Gallup, the famous for Gallup polling, was a dissertation student who wanted to know what do people read when they open up a newspaper. And he went to Iowans' homes. He was at the University of Iowa. And he watched them read the newspaper and figured out what the most popular bits were. People said they read the front page. They said they wanted to read news.
But they read the funnies first.
But they read the funnies first, and the women looked at the fashion photos. The most popular part of the paper was J.H. Darling's political cartoon. We have been Facebook readers for long, long before there was a Facebook to read. So there is an element, people should be dispirited by how conservative our opinions are, but technology has merely changed the way that we find information we've wanted to believe.
What do you mean by the phrase sneakily recognizable?
I think that one of the most important ideas from the book is that people want familiarity from pop culture.
So is that why movie sequels seem to do better than you might expect?
90% of the time.
Spinoffs on television?
Yep. 90% of the time we listen to music, we're listening to a song we've already heard. Every year, this decade, the majority of the top 10 films in America have been sequels, adaptations, or reboots. We want familiarity, but we also want to discover new things. And so the trick for hit makers is essentially, how do I design something that's new that opens a door to the familiar? And there's this lovely way to think of it that comes from psychology that balances fluency, which is a term for ease of thinking, with disfluency, which means difficulty of thinking. And they said the most beautiful moments of familiarity are those when we confront something that's anxious, and then it opens a door into something that's familiar. And they call it an aesthetic aha. It's a moment that offers this click of meaning. And that click of meaning, I think, is what people are trying to produce across the cultural landscape.
How does the Maya effect relate to that?
Maya, M-A-Y-A, most advanced yet acceptable, was a theory of liking by Raymond Loewy, the father of industrial design in the 1950s. He said people are torn between neophilia, they love new things, and neophobia, they hate new things. And so the trick when designing a car, a train, a pencil sharpener, was to design a product that was clearly new, but that was also sneakily familiar, that was Maya.
I always thought that the reason that we had all those sequels and movies that look like other movies was that the people who fund the movies are afraid of risking their money on something that that might not be a hit, although sometimes the sequels bomb.
Sometimes the sequels bomb, but they are better bets than original films. And that is precisely the risk that they face. They say, all right, well, we know that all original ventures are risky. But what is the least risky original venture? It's an original venture that is a sequel or adaptation of an already successful cultural product. And so that's why you see in movies that the business model in the last 20 years has completely reoriented itself. In 1996, none of the top 10 films were sequels. In 2016, six of the top 10 most popular films were sequels. The only exceptions, essentially, were the animated films, the lovely films for families. So clearly the business model of Hollywood has reoriented itself around familiar surprises, sneaky familiar.
And when people are putting together things that will appeal to kids, do they have any insight into what kids will respond to?
There isn't a lot of research on what appeals to children specifically in the book, but one thing I think is clearly known about kids is that they are even more in love with repetition than adults are. When they find a favorite show, they want to watch it over and over. When they find a favorite song, they want to watch it over and over. Adults are also into repetition of our favorite music and shows, but just not quite as much.
I always wondered why so many vampire movies are popular, movies about the living dead. Is it because we've seen others? What kinds of antecedents did the Star Wars movies have that made them feel new and old all at the same time?
George Lucas originally didn't want to write Star Wars. He wanted to produce a movie called Flash Gordon that was based on one of his favorite comics. But the owner of the comic turned him down. And so he essentially said, all right, if I can't make my favorite comic, I'll make something that's just like it, that is a kind of Sunday. I'm going to take bits of my favorite parts from all my favorite comics, and I'm going to combine them in one beautiful dessert that's made essentially for 10 and 11-year-old boys. And I'm just going to make it a bunch of things that I like. And so in a way, what Lucas did with Star Wars that I think made it so brilliant is that it is cliches, but it's a bunch of cliches reorganizing themselves in ways that they had never been reorganized. A bundle of previously unbundled illusions, and that is what makes it original.
We talked about how Top 40 Radio once sold records, but movies also sold records. And you tell the story of Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock, which was just sitting there. Nobody was paying attention until it was featured in Black Boy Jungle.
That's right. This is one of those stories that I think should teach all journalists to be careful about saying that all outcomes are inevitable. You know, we always like to say, oh, well, of course Donald Trump had to win the presidency. Of course this team had to win the Super Bowl. But we live in a weird probabilistic universe. Rock Around the Clock comes out in 1954. It's the B-side to a song called 18 Women, and it flops. But then a 10-year-old boy named Peter Ford is one of the few thousand people who buys the record. His father is the star of a movie called Blackboard Jungle. This little boy gives the song to the director when he's visiting the house, and the director puts it in the movie Blackboard Jungle. It plays at the beginning, in the middle, at the end, and it is only then, 2 weeks after this movie Blackboard Jungle comes out, a year later, that the song goes number one on Billboard Hot 100 and becomes the second best-selling song of all time.
Now, we've been talking about how scientists approach all of this, but doesn't this also apply to science? Because certain experiments wind up being, and studies wind up being funded, while other ones aren't, even though in retrospect, we sometimes discover that the one that was ignored and couldn't get any money turned out to be the one that was most important.
Exactly. And what's so interesting is that this bias toward the familiar that we've talked about in movies and music and politics is also an enormous bias in science. Max Planck himself said the reason that some ideas become law is not because they persuade people, but because those who disagree with it at the time eventually die off, and then it becomes law. And so if you're going, there have been studies that have shown that if you're trying to submit a paper for funding from the NIH, that the best papers, the most interesting, most popular papers, aren't those that are extremely novel, but also not those that are extremely familiar. Instead, they are those that are sneakily familiar, that advance a broadly familiar subject in a specific way.
We have very little time left, but would this be good advice if somebody's trying to predict the future trends?
Absolutely. I think that we should always look to the familiar to determine what people like, but then also look to broadcasting power, because those who own the biggest broadcasts dictate the future of popularity.
Derek Thompson is a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine. His book, Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction, published by Penguin Press. And Derek, I hope your book goes viral.
Thank you very much.